Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Kate Edgar, director of the Oliver Sacks Foundation, and your moderator for tonight's program, in which we're going to examine and celebrate the work of Oliver Sacks. He was the author of 15 books, including the new collection just published called The River of Consciousness. And his other books, as you may know, include The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, An Anthropologist on Mars, On the Move, and Gratitude. Mm-hmm. His book Awakenings inspired a 1990 film starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. The New York Times called Sacks the poet laureate of medicine. Our panel tonight is a very distinguished one, all of them friends of Oliver's and writers whose work he deeply admired. You'll hear more about their relationships as we go along. This is a very Oliver moment in which he loses his notes. Well, it's here.
Please drop the page.
Steve Silberman, at the far end, is the author of Neurotribes. He's the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, which has been called a genius page-turner. The New York Times called it beautifully told, humanizing, and important. Dr. Victoria Sweet. Dr. Sweet is a professor of clinical medicine at UCSF and the author of God's Hotel. Dr. Sacks called that book a most important book, which raises fundamental questions about the nature of medicine in our time, required reading for anyone interested in the humanity of healthcare. You may have something to say about healthcare later, but I'm sure he'd say much the same about Victoria's new book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. And Bill Hayes, next to me.
Yeah.
Bill is a photographer and the author of four books, the latest of which, Insomniac City. The New York Times called Frank beautiful and bewitching. Mm. It's a love letter to New York in words and photos, as well as an affectionate and moving tribute to his partner of 7 years, Dr. Oliver Sacks. So, wow, what a great panel. So, Billy, I'm going to start with you. You and I worked closely together with Oliver's editor at Knopf, Dan Frank,
right,
to publish this new book, The River of Consciousness. I think all three of us discovered some new aspects of Oliver's work during this process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, what I love about the new book, The River of Consciousness, is how it recapitulates themes and concepts that really pop up in all of his books. His love of history, absolutely. His interest in and his knowledge about Darwin and evolutionary biology. His fascination with the concept of chance. That comes up again and again. Sentience, consciousness, and the importance of the individual. And I think what I especially love about the book, there's so many passages of just sheerly beautiful writing. Those appear in all of his books, I suppose, but they come together here with all those other elements in such a gorgeous way. I think Steve was saying, there's no one but Oliver Sacks who could have written this book. It's an unusual collection of themes and concepts.
Mm. and one that he'd really been thinking about for a number of years.
Yeah.
In some ways, throughout his life. Victoria, your work as a physician shares so many parallels with Oliver's, and I know that your own work moved and inspired him greatly. In particular, I'm thinking of a day that Oliver and I shared with you a few years ago at Laguna Honda. And both of you spent a lot of time working in charity hospitals for the chronically ill that most doctors, or many doctors, would prefer to avoid. Why was that an important choice for you both?
Well, I'll answer that in a second, but let me say, when I was thinking about coming here and thinking about Oliver's effect in my life, and I didn't actually meet him very many times, but they were all really important. And this particular time, he'd read my book proposal before I'd submitted it, and he was helpful with it. He didn't even know me. And after he read it, he turned to you, Kate. He called out because she had a different room in their office. And he says, Kate, next time we're in San Francisco, I need to see Laguna Honda. So about a year and a half later, they were in San Francisco. And probably this is an answer to your question that you asked, actually, because he wanted to see Laguna Honda because he'd actually done his residency in Mount Zion been at Mount Zion here in San Francisco. But he'd, like me, had admitted many people to Laguna Honda, but he'd never been there. So Kate called me up, and I was so excited at the idea of having Oliver Sacks come to Laguna Honda, in part because we were in a really, at the time at Laguna Honda was when all the stuff started to happen. The Department of Justice had shown up, and HICFA, and the disability people, and nobody liked the place, and they just didn't like the whole thing. And the left doesn't write it, the right doesn't like it, and Oliver was going to come. And what was so exciting to me about it was he brings history with him. He brings tradition. Mm-hmm. And what got me thinking, and is what I'm thinking about in relation to the charity hospital, because both he and I feel that medicine is a profession in a tradition, and the continuity of the tradition is what's makes it really, you can't cut it. So when he came and we walked around, what he liked is what I liked about the charity hospital. And it's not that it's a charity, at least not for me. Mm-hmm. If it had cost a lot of money, I still would have liked it. But it was the beauty of the place, this old-fashioned, this looking back into history, the medieval aspects of it, the 19th century aspects of it. It was built in 1926, but it harkened back to time. So it had time involved in it. And then the patients, I think, his patients, like my patients, those patients are fascinating because they're survivors. You don't make it to a charity hospital unless you're a survivor, because you're poor by definition. And so one of the reasons that charity patients are so interesting is if you're going to make it as a charity patient, you have to be 2 or 3 standard deviations from a mean. You can't just be a regular person. You have to be really ugly or really beautiful. You have to be really charming or a real jerk. You have to be, otherwise you just get lost. And so the patients are so interesting. And taking you and him around was so just delightful. And I think the moment that got me about the charity hospital was he took a chart out, and we still had the paper charts, and he sat down with it, and he just ran his hand over it, you know, and I feel the same way about them. And he just started turning the page, and he just got caught by the story that those paper charts encapsulated by definition. And he just started reading. He read the whole thing, which fortunately for me was one of my particularly good workups. So so I think it was the charity hospital, the patients, and the place, actually, are the two things that harkens back and inserts you back into history. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say.
You have a wonderful story about charts in your new book, Slow Medicine, which actually I think you were a medical student at the time. Do I have that right?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you mean the man with the hole in his head,
yes.
That one? Well, this was when I was really a baby medical student, right? I was in the very beginning of when you go into the hospital. And first, as a third-year student, you at least traditionally would learn how to examine a patient. And my first clerkship was in neurology, as a matter of fact, because it was in neurology and psychiatry. And we had a patient who had been there, been back in and out of the neurology ward, who was psychotic, he was manic, and he had chronic head pain. And he'd gone in and out for years, and nobody could figure out what was wrong with him. And so my resident gave me his chart, which at the time obviously was not electronic. They were literally five charts, and they were each about a telephone book in size. And, you know, I was a young student. I didn't have anything else to do. So I sat down all afternoon and paged through those charts, so the one you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And right in the middle of them, there was a little note by some other doctor 5 years ago saying that he'd had an elevated calcium level. This one little sentence. And perhaps he had multiple myeloma, which can cause an elevated calcium level, but which can also cause people to be confused, somewhat manic and psychotic, and also have head pain because multiple myeloma can give you holes in your skull. And I read that one sentence and I was like, whoa. I didn't even know anything about multiple myeloma, so I went to the library and I read about it, and I came back and I told my resident, and he thought, well, that's an interesting idea. And we took the x-ray, and he had holes in his head. He had multiple myeloma, and that's what he had. We had a diagnosis, and we had a treatment. So these paper charts that we used to have are one of the things I talk about in this new book, this value of the story, of having the whole thing in a codex form, in a chart form, where you can read the story. And that's what Oliver was doing at Laguna Honda that day. He was
right.
Sitting there and just, he got lost, you know, because that's the other thing he did. He just was lost, gone.
And this is very much what happened when Oliver encountered the patients that he wrote about in Awakenings. Some of these patients had been in hospital for 30 or 40 years, and he went back, and at the time, again, they had still paper charts, and read these mm-hmm. charts all the way through and began to see patterns and similarities between the patients that one probably is less likely to see in a computerized set of details. But I want to give a question to Steve on a different topic. Oliver often protested that he had no interest in politics. He was much more interested in science and nature. But yeah. I would argue that his essays on many conditions, whether deafness or Tourette's syndrome or autism, were deeply political in a way, although he may have resisted that particular label. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience of his writing on autism, beginning with his profile of Temple Grandin?
Sure. In fact, I was just rereading Oliver's profile of Temple as it appeared in The New Yorker and as I originally read it today. And then, of course, in between the first time I read it and today, one of the things that I did was to spend, you know, 10 years thinking about autism and 5 years researching and writing Neurotribes. And what amazed me was how much Oliver knew about the history of autism purely through, in a sense, intuition and because of the compassion with which he regarded his patients and anyone around him, in a sense. And there were so many things that Oliver got right intuitively, mm-hmm. including there was a funny moment today because he talks about the uncanny similarity between two descriptions of autism by Hans Asperger and Leo Kanner. And one of the things that I figured out for my book was that there was actually they shared a research assistant, which nobody knew. But I thought it was interesting that Oliver noticed that they were uncannily similar. He didn't realize that there was actually one person who had worked with them both, but he sort of smelled it in a way. Mm-hmm. And he got so many things right. And what everyone forgets now, because the world has changed so much, is that when Oliver wrote that profile of Temple, the idea of an autistic adult was still new. Mm-hmm. In fact, the diagnosis would not really be available to adults and teenagers in America until the following year, 1994, when Lorna Wing made some changes in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So he was really in new territory. And he even has a line where he says, everyone talks about autistic children, but nobody talks about autistic adults, as if the children somehow disappear from the face of the earth. Mm. And that's one of those things that he's able to slip in, and, you know, he's a clinician, and it's like, well, what does happen to these autistic children as they grow up? But it's actually a revolution, in a sense, because the difference between children and one difference between children and adults is that adults can speak for themselves and adults can create culture. And there's a fascinating kind of mini profile in his profile of Temple of this family, the Bees, who were, he called them the Bees, and they were an autistic family. And they were not, you know, ashamed of their autism, or, you know, they didn't think that they did interesting things in spite of their autism. And in fact, he points out that the Bees had these very explicit directions in the kitchen about, you know, how to serve foods and stuff. And when Oliver first came into the apartment, he thought, well, okay, you know, autistic people need really explicit instructions. And then he finally realized, and says in the essay, that it was an autistic in-joke. Autistic people weren't even considered to be capable of humor or irony at that point. Yeah. So to talk about an autistic in-joke is to give full humanity to a whole group of people who had been reduced to a checklist of deficits and dysfunctions for decades. And that's political.
Well, I, thank you for that. I agree.
That's gorgeous.
And the thing that's so remarkable to me about Oliver is that he did that for group after group of people.
Yeah, yeah. What you said really resonated with me about how he would slip in these little, these insights that have held up and that are timeless. Mm-hmm. I was reading The River of Consciousness on the flight here. I've read it many times now. It was probably the fifth time. But a phrase popped out at me that I thought was so beautiful. It's in the chapter called Speed, which is about movement and speed. And he's at one point writing about people with Tourette's syndrome and remarking about their amazing facility and quickness of movement. And he says of Tourette's, it's a neurological gift of sorts. And I thought that was such a beautiful way to describe it, radical in a way, as a neurological gift rather than a disability or a difference or something freaky. And this is in the new book, but of course he was writing things like that many years ago, acknowledging people with differences in such a beautiful and generous way.
Yeah. I think you both touched on intuition in a way, and there's a chapter in the new book in which Oliver talks about creativity, intuition, incubation, all kinds of influences. Did that resonate with any of you in terms of your own creative process? Or?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that I was thinking about my book for 10 years and being busy doing other things, like the way that I met Oliver was that I wrote this article on autism in high-tech communities like Silicon Valley in 2001 called The Geek Syndrome for Wired.
Right.
And what's so funny is that there's an essay in Oliver's new book about the fallibility of memory and misremembering things. And in my mind, I remember, Kate, you calling me at the airport on my cell phone, but I probably didn't have a cell phone. I forget how you got in touch with me. But you said, you know, Oliver liked the essay, which, you know, I was incredibly honored. But I happened to be going to New York. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I said, well, why don't I come and visit you? So I went down to Oliver's office. And my first in-person meeting of Oliver, he was wearing a bathing suit, which is very appropriate. And because I did not know him at all, and in fact, I look back at my incredible naivete, I said something like, why don't I come with you to London, you know, where he was going to do an Uncle Tungsten book tour. But I think he looked at me with a look of pity and said something like, well, why don't you talk about it with Kate? But it actually worked out, you know, it worked out. And so I got to spend several days in London with Oliver. We walked through the Science Museum in South Kensington. He went to the place where the old periodic table with the actual samples of the elements were. Mm-hmm. He put down his cushion, sat down, and wept. And it was so beautiful. We went to his old house. His old bedroom had been turned into a psychoanalyst couch. Mm-hmm. We were like peering in the windows, you know. But that's how I got to know Oliver, was hanging out in London. And if I had not been so naive, it never would have happened.
That's a great story. Yeah, I don't know how many of you have been to London, but there in the Natural History Museum there's a bust of Charles Darwin, who, of course, is one of Oliver's great heroes and who figures quite prominently in this current book. But he and his boyhood friends, Jonathan Miller and Eric Korn, both brilliant people as well, used to spend quite a lot of time there. So that was, for him, the holy grail there.
One thing that comes up quite often in this book is how much he hated school.
Yes.
And that comes up a lot in his work. You know, he was really self-taught and taught himself through reading. Mm-hmm. And at the Natural History Museum, that was his school and his church as well. But there are lots of amusing lines about how much he abhorred school, including medical school, I have to say. It wasn't until he started working with patients that he really found his identity and found his voice as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Billy, we know how Steve and Victoria met Oliver. Would you like to tell us how you...
Sure. I was living here in San Francisco. I lived here for 25 years. And in early 2008, I got a letter in the mail one day, return address, Oliver Sacks, New York, New York. And I was working at the time at my friend's amazing clothing store, the greatest clothing store in the world, Modern Appealing Clothing, MAC. And I remember bringing the letter in to Scott and Ben and Chris Hospital and saying, you're not going to believe this, but I got a letter from Oliver Sacks. Well, he had read my book, The Anatomist, which had come out a couple of months before. He read the book, and he just wanted to write to me and say how much he enjoyed it. And he told me a little story about how he'd grown up in a family of physicians. There was a copy of Grey's Anatomy in the house. So my book was telling the story behind Grey's Anatomy, and he was very pleased to learn more about Henry Grey. So what would you do if you got a letter from Oliver Sacks? I wrote a letter back, handwritten, and then he wrote a letter back to me. And so we had a little correspondence, very formal and collegial. And then about a year later, I moved to New York for separate reasons, not having to do with Oliver. And once there, also had an apartment in the West Village, and she started to see a lot of me as Oliver and I got acquainted and fell in love.
And the rest is history. You can read about it in Insomniac City.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the things that fascinated Oliver and probably all of us is a quest for individuality. And in this current book, as well as the previous book, On the Move, he makes it really clear that none of us really has the option to choose not to be individual. Mm. That this is a fate, if you will, that's built into our neural architecture. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if this is a question or a statement, but do any of you have reflections on that? Have you followed Oliver's looking into neuroscience with Gerald Edelman's work?
It comes out so beautifully in that first classic New York Times essay, My Own Life, where he wrote about his terminal cancer diagnosis. Yeah. There's the most gorgeous line in that piece where he says, it is the fate, the genetic and neurological fate of every human being to be a unique individual, to follow his own path, to live his own life, to die his own death. And for me, I mean, he had articulated that before, but never so beautifully. There's something so freeing in that idea, mm-hmm. that you are fated to be an individual, whatever you are, however you are.
and that that individuality has to be respected for everyone.
That's the respect that he gave to his patients. He gave them, you know, the ability to claim individuality outside of their medicalized context. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like one of his meta themes is how his patients creatively became even more individual in the course of whatever disorder or condition he was treating them for.
That particularly for me came out with his book, An Anthropologist on Mars, where a lot of the people he profiles are artists of one sort and another, whose art actually becomes transformed and taken to a higher level by their quote-unquote disability.
This comes up in the new book, too, in The River of Consciousness, the title essay, where he talks about consciousness, not an easy thing to write about or even understand, something he makes accessible somehow, and defines it in a way that's sort of easy to understand about how we are the directors of the film we are making, and we are its subject, too, and personalizing consciousness in a very individual way, taking on these big abstract topics in this new book, but making them accessible.
One of the things I think is really fascinating about that essay, and Kate, I remember I talked to you about this when Oliver was writing it, actually, is that his description of consciousness as discontinuous or a succession of almost cinematographic moments or snapshots. What was interesting to me was that I just happened to, when I read the initial draft of that essay, I had just done an in-depth profile of a Buddhist teacher. And his description of his own consciousness after literally years of deep meditation in Thailand was so similar to what Oliver was writing about, but from the scientific side. And I remember I tried to interest Oliver that because it smacked of religion. He had no interest whatsoever. Yes, but yet, it was fascinating to me that through science, looking using instruments and brain imaging and anatomy, that they were coming to a similar model of consciousness from people who were just sitting in forests in Thailand looking at the process of their own minds for years.
Fascinating. Yes, we had a similar conversation for many years.
Yeah.
I should interject an audience question because we maybe didn't make it clear. Who is Temple Grandin? Do you want to give a brief description?
Sure. She's an autistic woman who is a leading industrial designer. She works to make basically stockyards and slaughterhouses more humane, because she has a compassionate affinity. She feels a compassionate affinity for animals. And most people's first view of an autistic adult, even people in the field of autism, really, was Rain Man, the movie, in 1988. But, you know, several years later, Temple was sort of like the real-life autistic adult with all of the complexity that Raymond Babbitt didn't have. And she's also just hilarious and wonderful. And that all comes through in Oliver's profile.
This is an audience question as well. And I was hoping to ask you each to talk about what's your favorite book of Oliver's, if you could pick one.
Who wants to start?
I'm supposed to start?
I said, who wants to start?
I'll start because I think I like Uncle Tungsten. I like this River of Consciousness a lot. I read it a couple of times, and I was struck by that, and then Gratitude. It seemed to me that I've always actually liked his more autobiographical, more memoir. So I loved Uncle Tungsten because it just that whole period of life just came to life for me. And then the Rivers of Consciousness. I found myself drawn, it seemed to me to take off from where he left with Gratitude, in the sense, although I know they were collected pieces he'd written before, I think. Yes or not?
Ingratitude?
Yeah, no, not ingratitude. In Rivers of
River
Consciousness.
River of Consciousness,
right.
Is, yes.
So but he'd put them together, and I was intrigued by the order in which he'd put these pieces together, because I was asking myself, what was he doing with this order? Because he certainly picked these previously written pieces for a reason, and he put them together in a certain way. And it was interesting, so I will confess that usually when I get a book that consists of people's previously published papers or chapters or stories or whatever, I never read it from beginning to end. I'll just rant because I figure, well, you know,
dip in.
It wasn't done that way, so I'll just randomly read it. So that's the way I first read it. Then I started to get a feeling of what I thought he was doing or what he was doing for me in this book. So I was like, I think I actually do need to read this from beginning to end, because I think he's doing something here on purpose. And I'm a little hesitant to say, because these people know it really well and they were talking with him, so I'm really going out there with what I felt. But what he did is he took me, first of all, he really did get me start, and I don't think about consciousness very much, you know. I did when I was like in college, but I sort of put that away. You know, no, really, I mean, thinking about consciousness. So I started his book, and I'm going, what is he doing here? Then we got to, there's this chapter on plants and their sentience of plants. And then my favorite chapter, well, I think the one that pushed it for me was his chapter on speed. So, of course, as a slow medicine person, naturally, I would like his chapter on speed. Because he's not just talking about fast, he's talking about slow. Mm-hmm. And he talked about something that I've thought a lot about, because I have a backyard, and we're in California, and I have this big oak tree in this backyard that's like 400 years old. And for years I've thought about what the world seems to a 400-year-old tree, right? That this big tree, 400 years old, I mean, imagine what it's lived through and what life must seem like to him, you know. It's like sitting there living, and these people sort of appear, you know, wearing red coats or whatever on this country, and they all run around, and they chop down a bunch of trees, and, you know, buildings come up and buildings come down, and this sort of very, very quick, and that my life for the tree is like coming in, and I move this around, and I paint this, and I do this, and I'm going to die. I'm going to leave again. Right? Auverleaf talks about that. He talks about the slowness of a life, right? If you're a big old tree, you would see your minutes are different from our minutes. They're not the same minutes. They're much shorter in a way, or you could say the tree's minutes are much longer from my point of view. And then he does the reverse in that. Where he talks about, you know, an animal, a fly or something who lives 36 hours, and how their life might be the same amount of experiences, which would mean that they would see things moving like this. They'd see everything so deeply. So I found that very intriguing, and as you can see, it started sucking me into this place that I don't usually go, which is this thinking about existence, actually. And I wondered whether, because he was facing his own death as he was writing this, and it, you know, his own loss of consciousness or not, what does consciousness mean? What does memory mean if you're not any longer there to have a memory? So I'm putting the Rivers of Consciousness in Uncle Tungsten, I would say, for my faves.
Very nice.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Steve, favorite book?
Awakenings, probably. Okay. It's amazing, you know, and there's one particular essay that I believe is only in certain editions of Awakenings called Parkinsonian Space and Time.
That's right.
It was one of the most absolutely mind-blowing pieces of writing I've ever read. And you know, when I was a little kid, I fell in love with books because of science fiction and Ray Bradbury and stuff. Mm. It was as cool as any science fiction story I ever read. And I have to say that when I read it, I suspected, even though this was not on public record at the time, that Oliver had taken psychedelics. Mm. And so when I got him alone, once I knew him, I said, Oliver, when I read Parkinsonian Space and Time, I knew you'd taken acid. Did you? You know, and he had, of course.
Of course.
You know, and it's a completely mind-stretching book, and it's as incredibly awesome as anything that anyone could imagine, but it's real.
And, indeed.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, obviously, Anthropologist on Mars is amazing. It's hard for me to, yeah.
Well, that particular essay, it's an appendix in the current version of Awakenings, which was done in 1990, but it brings up again how these topics just obsessed Oliver for his entire lifetime.
Yeah.
Beginning, and he talks a lot about, since you mentioned science fiction, mm-hmm. Science fiction was huge for him, especially as a boy, but into his adult life, he talked a lot about H.G. Wells in this current book.
Yep.
And I think that you can just see this young boy being ignited by literature as well as the science museum and doctoring.
We keep talking about speed, this chapter speed. It opens with a really beautiful line where he says, as a boy, I was fascinated by speed, the wild range of speed in the world around me. And I think Oliver himself had a kind of wild range of speeds.
Yeah.
Yes. From very shy, very, very shy, to very exuberant. And there's also a kind of wild range to his work, which is one of the remarkable things. In 15 books, there are, of course, the medical or neurological case histories for which he's so well known, like Awakenings, An Anthropologist on Mars. But there are also amazing, beautifully written travel chronicles, like Oaxaca Journal, or probably my favorite of all of his books, The Island of the Colorblind, which is both a kind of medical exploration of colorblindness, but also a beautiful travel chronicle. And then, of course, his memoir and memoirs and autobiography. And I think he also really perfected, for himself at least, the art of the personal essay.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's this incredible range that I think we're just beginning to really understand, range as a writer.
Mm. Well, one of the things that's so exhilarating about his writing is that so many times scientists these days or, you know, study in a relatively narrow field and become masters of that field. Or if they publish, particularly if they have a hit book, then they publish 5 more books on the subject. But Oliver was constantly roaming with his curiosity and giving a much more full picture of a curious, very alive human mind, you know?
And also willing to plunge into things he didn't know much about.
Right.
Like the deaf community and deaf culture and seeing voices. Something he didn't really know a lot about until he dove into that book, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he clearly wanted to be more than just somebody publishing in journals. And one of the most fun conversations I ever had about Oliver when he wasn't there was with the poet Tom Gunn, who had really mentored Oliver when Oliver was young. And Tom told me that Oliver was so shy that he would just leave journals on Tom's porch, which happened to be right across the street from where I lived. He would just leave them there, and then Tom would find them and then make comments and return them to Oliver. And Tom was one of the greatest poets of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to find out that not only did Oliver emulate Tom Gunn, but also Auden, who was a very good friend, you know, he was far beyond just a narrow specialist.
Very true. I have a question saying, Kate, your guests have told us how they met Oliver and the nature of their relationships. What about you? Yeah. Well, I'm sorry we weren't able to show that clip earlier.
Explain that.
I was a young editor and freelancing here in San Francisco and rather desperate for work. And I got a phone call saying, would you type this manuscript for us? And I said, sure. It was an old boss of mine who said, this is right down your alley. It's medical and sort of intellectual. And the only thing is, it's handwritten. and he said, of course, it was Oliver. And Oliver, he said, Oliver, I haven't gotten a handwritten manuscript in 30 years. And Oliver replies, well, it is called a manuscript. And then Jim Silberman says, well, but it looks like it's been dropped in the bath. And Oliver went on to explain how he loved to swim, and he would swim. He had this lake that he would go to on weekends, and he would swim, and a thought would come to him, and he'd clamber out onto shore and write something down. So this manuscript that came to me, which was it was a section of a leg to stand on, and it really was cryptic. I get many emails from people saying, oh, I'm so excited to get a handwritten letter from Oliver, but could you please translate? So
that's true.
So I typed this bit, and that was the beginning of our relationship.
And he felt he'd never been edited as well ever in his life. And he said, who is this woman? She's fabulous.
Oh, wow.
It's in the film. And then you started a working relationship. And you worked together on every book until The River of Consciousness.
Yes, and revised a couple of the other ones. So, yeah. Good. So did you tell us your favorite? Yes, you did.
Island of the Colorblind. I also love Seeing Voices, which, for those who aren't familiar with it, is a really beautiful and fascinating narrative nonfiction account of deaf culture, deaf community. And as in all of his books, there's Oliver in there too, trying to learn American Sign Language and really thinking deeply about language. So it's also about language in a larger sense. It's a wonderful book.
I will say, although I can't possibly single one out, that Anthropologist on Mars was one of the first books of his that really changed the way my brain worked. And there were a number of essays that they were just so thought-provoking. One about one about Temple Grandin, and one about a painter who loses suddenly his sense of color. And this is a devastating problem, but then he is able to reimagine himself as a black and white being, if you will. There's another essay, and I just got this card, who's the writing I think I recognize. There's a chapter about Franco Magnani, who many of you may know was the wonderful painter himself who was the subject of an exhibit at the Exploratorium some years ago, and who paints these remarkable, very detailed scenes of the village he grew up in Italy, despite the fact that he hadn't, at that point, been back to the village for many, many years. So, Franco, if you're out there, hello. Someone asks, if you could design a patient you think would fascinate Oliver,
cool.
What would he or she be like?
Oliver.
Yes. I would say, Oliver was interested in so many different types of people, and he saw, as a neurologist, any patients. He didn't sort of pick and choose, oh, that person has a really interesting problem, so I want to see this person. He saw all kinds of people with minor complaints, major complaints. One of the great things about his job at the Little Sisters of the Poor, he worked in many of their residences over the years, and he was the sort of house neurologist. So every time a new patient came in, at a certain point, they would get a neurological evaluation just to be sure that everything was fine. So he was really looking at a broad range of people, some of whom had no problems at all.
That's true.
He tells a wonderful story of a woman who was admitted She was 100 years old, and she'd been living on her own, but she had, I believe she had a problem with her eyes. She was blind. Maybe she had to have cataracts removed, and she...
Is this the tea and toast story? No.
No. Okay. It's a
different patient.
We're working on many of these stories. And after her problem was resolved and she could see well again, she said, "Well, I'm leaving." She says, "Who wants to hang out with all these old people? I'm going home." You know. So she had no neurological problems at all. And he just enjoyed that broad range of humanity that he came into contact with.
I do think if the doctor from Doctor Who was brought to him as a patient with a weird neurological disorder, he would have loved that.
Okay.
You know, he published a lot, 15 books, but there were also books that got away. Books he lost or manuscripts he lost.
Oh.
Or destroyed.
And then books that he had planned to write, even maybe got contracts to write, but did end up writing. Mm. So there was supposed at one point to be a whole book on Tourette syndrome. In fact, the Guggenheim Fellowship he got was for Tourette's research, right?
Yes. He invented a new term, which was neuroanthropology.
Right.
Something with Victoria practices.
There's one essay of his that has eluded my grasp that I would love to see. Apparently, when he was very young and working in the Bronx, he wrote a story about how these allegedly non-communicative, non-verbal patients were actually communicating all the time. Mm. And it was printed in the hospital newsletter. Mm. If Bill Morgan ever digs up that essay, I would love to read it.
Okay, I'm going to read an audience question. Did Oliver ever address the differences or parallels between the prominence he gives to the evolutionary necessity of the individual and Buddhism, focusing on diminishing the prominence of the individual?
Hmm. That sounds like
anyone.
I think he does it through science. You know, I think in a sense he didn't need Buddhism in a way.
Mm.
You know, I think he challenges the notion of a static identity from it, in you know, coming up with some of the same insights as Buddhism, but he does it through neurology.
And do you think that part of it is his fascination with nature and being a part of this incredible process that's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I forget where it comes from, but didn't he once say that science is his religion?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And furthermore, even though he didn't say it in the same sentence, his spiritual practice was precise observation and learning from the precise observers of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. It's almost amusing how many of the authors quoted in River of Consciousness are from the 19th century.
Mm. they were definitely his touchstones. And he used to bemoan the fact that he wasn't a good bench scientist. He wasn't the kind of scientist that goes to win Nobel Prizes through experimentation and breakthroughs. But he was an observer, and the 19th century natural historians were all about observation, as medicine should be about observation, and Victoria talks about that in her book.
Well, I think his 19th century, I was also struck when I was reading Rivers of Consciousness, because that's another thing I feel like I share with him, is this connection with the 19th century, and since he was a bit older than me, he's closer to it, and it's really some texture of medicine that was developed then. Part of it was the physical exam, all of the neurology and the neurological exam was developed then, and I think in medicine especially, it's layered, right? It's you build on the past, and to cut off your relationship with the past is just an irrevocable mistake. And so when I was reading the Rivers of Consciousness, and he keeps referring back to these wonderful thinkers, I mean, Darwin and Freud, and you can feel how they're observers trying to have the actual physical world teach them answers to questions that religion has been trying to answer. Mm-hmm. And it was like, why don't we just look at what we've got? And then their ways of doing it, they were so meticulous and so indefatigable, right? They just were amazing. He talks, I'm not a big Darwin fan, I confess. But I could get to be more of a fan because he talked about Darwin pollinating, lying in the grass, and
right.
pollinating.
Awesome. Right.
His at hand. What could you remember?
Face down on the grass.
Face down. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a whole side of Darwin that I knew nothing about. Reading that essay in River of Consciousness, and just so lovely. And I can still see the sentence in my mind where Oliver says, you know, pictures Darwin lying mm-hmm. face down on the grass, doing this incredibly meticulous work. It's so beautiful and sensual and anything but dry and so alive.
And it asks nature the question.
Exactly.
And then you have to be prepared to get an answer back that you don't like.
I didn't think of this until today. Someone brought it up. But that scene, and it's the chapter called Darwin and the Meaning of Flowers, had a kind of personal mm-hmm. resonance or mirror in his own life. There's a passage in my book, Insomniac City, where the husband of one of his nieces recalls how she first met Oliver Sacks, how he first met Oliver Sacks. And I believe he was engaged to get married to Caroline. And he came to the Sacks family house in London, and as he was approaching the front door, he saw this very large bearded man lying on the ground in the garden. And he thought that was very strange, and he came into the house and met Caroline's parents and the rest of the Sacks family, and then this large bearded man, Oliver, came in, and he said, "What were you doing?" And Oliver said to him, "I was wondering what it's like to be a rose."
Oh, wow. Wow.
And it sounds apocryphal, but it was Nikki telling this story, someone yeah. who would, you know, not make that up.
True.
Yeah, one thing I want to say, Billy, is that, you know, I mean, I got to spend wonderful times with Oliver, but reading Insomniac City, I got to see a side of him that was really just for you and him, was so playful and so sweet. And it really, even though I thought I knew him pretty well mm-hmm. before I read Insomniac City, it really opened up a whole side of him that he did not give to the world, in a sense, but kept for himself and you.
Yeah, he was a very, very private man, as you know, and he did have this very playful side, and that wild range of speeds, which is what I tried to capture in the scenes in Insomniac City.
I have a question from the audience. How did his homosexuality influence his sense of difference? Hmm. And perhaps allied to that, Oliver had neuroses of his own.
Oh,
I was told he had trouble choosing a restaurant. How did this help him relate to his patients? Well, I'm sure we all have very...
Why don't you start?
How would
you answer that?
Choosing a restaurant was indeed...
Indecisiveness.
Very difficult.
And diffidence.
And once we got to a restaurant and stayed, he would often have trouble choosing a dish, so he would like to order. Well, he'd say, "I'll have one of everything. You know, let's get one of everything, and we could share them." And you know, when you're at a Japanese restaurant, that's a lot of dishes.
A lot of sushi.
It's a lot of sushi. So, but he did have a sense of affinity that was quite strong. So, if I said, "Oh, I want the chicken soup," then he would feel compelled to have the chicken soup as well, which led to some interesting. Back and forth.
So the first part about his homosexuality, I get asked that a lot because of my book, which is natural that we were partners, and I write about our relationship and his journey or struggle to come out, which was long and really wasn't public until his autobiography was published in spring of 2015, just 3 months before he died. So yes, that was part of his identity and perhaps part of why he identified with his patients. But it was much more complex than that, I think. It wasn't just because he was gay. You know, one of the signal facts was that his older brother was schizophrenic, and that was a very powerful influence on his life and the patients that he saw and the respect and dignity that he gave them because he saw Michael's suffering. And that really comes out in his autobiography, On the Move. So I think it wasn't just his gayness that made him feel that identification with people who are different, but lots of different things. And of course, as we've said, he grew up in a family of doctors. So he was, both of his parents were surgeons and doctors. He saw a lot of different conditions.
Yes, a lot of life and death. And he talks in Uncle Tungsten, which is a memoir about his childhood, essentially, up until maybe the age of 14 or so. He talks about, as a young boy, going on house calls with his father, who was a general practitioner, mm-hmm. and would drive around and visit all his patients. And he tells a charming story about how his father, there are many charming stories about his father, but one is that he would go to each patient's house and look in the fridge to see what they had, maybe help himself to a bit, and but get to know the texture of these people's lives and their relationships to each other and so forth.
When I met Oliver, he was still closeted. Mm-hmm. And what's unusual about that is that he had been out sort of as a young, or at mm-hmm. least lived publicly as a gay man, as a young resident here. I mean, at least within the gay subculture.
Of the Y.
Right. But, you know, by the time he became famous as Oliver Sacks, he had gone back in. And I remember a very, very poignant conversation that I had with him when I was writing a profile of Oliver for Wired called The Fully Immersive Mind of Oliver Sacks. And in the course of my writing it, he intuited or was perhaps tipped off that I had figured out that he was gay. Mm. And I'm gay too. And so he called me to, in a sense, ask me not to out him, which I told him I wouldn't do. But he ended up liking the profile enough that we became friends. And at some point, he told me in a handwritten letter that he was having dreams about me and my future husband, Keith. And I thought that was a very good sign because I thought it meant that, you know, I mean, I felt, you know, like I didn't deserve to even be dreamed about by Oliver Sacks. But I felt that if we were working in his, you know, subconscious or whatever at that level, that he was trying to grow and using us as proud and loving couple, gay mm-hmm. couple, was probably good. And Billy, I have to say, I was so happy mm-hmm. when he met you. I was so incredible.
I was happy to meet him.
It was a fabulous moment.
I didn't know all that history, which was probably for the best.
Right. No pressure. I just want to take a little bit of issue with one thing, and this is that it may have been different in San Francisco in the 1960s. I don't know. I was only, you know, five. But when Oliver, first of all, Oliver grew up in England at a time when people were being jailed for being homosexuals. People were being chemically castrated, like Alan Turing. Mm-hmm. It was not okay to be out. It was very fraught, very dangerous for people, gay people at that time, much more so even than now, in this country at least. As a doctor, he had a special problem there because I was speaking with one of his colleagues who knew him back in 1965 when he moved to New York and started teaching at the medical college there. And she said, you know, in those days, you could not be a gay doctor. You would have been defrocked. Mm-hmm. So this was a problem. It's hard for him to really be able to embrace that part of himself publicly.
Well, there was also what his mother said to him.
Mm-hmm. And and I'll just tell that story for those of you who haven't read On the Move. Do you mean On the Move, don't I?
Mm-hmm.
As Oliver was getting ready to go off to university, he went to Oxford, his father decided it was time to have that father-son chat, about girls. And Oliver said, "Pa, it's okay. I like boys. But don't tell Ma, because she won't be able to take it." Well, the next day, apparently Pop did tell Ma, and Ma came down and really, she said to Oliver, "You are an abomination. You should never have been born." And it was a horrible, horrible curse that he writes about in On the Move. And I think in a very sympathetic way, as he got older, he began to understand that this woman was a product of her own times, and mm-hmm. she was fearful for him. She was fearful that having lost one son to schizophrenia, that she would lose another to homosexuality, which she viewed as an impossible life. So he did have a lot of baggage.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that he conveniently went back in the closet. It was very much...
I don't know how much he was... he did live the life, partly, here in San Francisco, but I think that was a very separate thing from his medical life, or mm-hmm. perhaps even his weightlifting life, which is another thing he writes about in On the Move. He was quite into lifting very heavy weights. I think we have a little time for one more topic. How do we help the mentally ill living on the streets is one question. That's a really big question, and I don't know that any of us are prepared to answer that, but I think that Oliver had a deep interest in community care, and one of the things that he looked into fairly late in life was the idea that there are certain places, like Laguna Honda in some
right.
way,
mm-hmm.
asylums, that could asylum. Provide a role for a person
Haven.
To...
Right.
Part in a community and a family.
Yeah, he and I actually talked about that when we walked around Laguna Honda a couple of times, and it was a pleasure for me because it's, heresy ever since Goffman's work on institutionalization of the mentally ill in the early 60s, which led to the closing of all the state mental hospitals. And the idea originally was that they wouldn't just be closed, there'd be a place for them. There'd be a community mental health centers, and there would be doctors, and there would be primary care and place to go, and they'd be treated because now we had treatment for the mentally ill. But that never happened because they closed down the mental institutions, and the next year they cut all the budget pretty much. That's why we have the mentally ill on the streets. But even apart from that, both he and I, it was a pleasure for me because he talked about asylums.
Right.
They give you asylum. That's the point. That's why they're called asylums. That it used to be that there were places you could go to get away if you were hypersensitive to noise and chaos and couldn't manage. You had some place to go. And it's what we're missing. There's psychiatrists who talk about this now. We're sort of realizing, I think, that we lost it and we need them back. So Laguna Honda, which was originally the San Francisco almshouse, the almshouse was actually a place that originally anybody could go. So anybody, all the people we don't know what to do with today that have no slot because we've had slots and then we shut them down, you could always first send to the almshouses. You could send, people who are chronically ill, but you could send the unemployed, the homeless, people who are just out of prison, the mentally ill, they would go and get asylum. And then out of the almshouses grew state mental hospitals, which definitely had problems, mm-hmm. but we had them. And if you talk to people who worked in some of them, was like here in Napa, they were beautiful farms and people could do something. So that, I think, is we're missing, fundamentally missing that. actually. Mm-hmm. And I think Oliver would agree with me.
He wrote an essay, a fantastic, beautiful essay called Asylum, right? Mm-hmm. Which we are hoping to include in the next book.
Next book.
Yeah. The River of Consciousness is out now. We're so proud of that. But we're also right at work now on the next book. He left a lot of uncollected and unpublished work. And there's an amazing essay called Asylum, which I'm sure you've read, about that very topic.
And on the, as you mentioned with Asylum, he loved to delve into the history of words, their etymology, and trace that, the sort of developing concept through that etymology. And Billy, you've written something wonderful about Oliver's love of language. Maybe well, you could end us with a nice story about it.
Well, I just never met anyone like this who, I remember once he said to me, every day a word surprises me. And it was true that every single day, at least once, maybe 5-10 times a day, he would ask for a dictionary because he had a whole shelf of different dictionaries, or get one himself and with his various magnifying glasses look up words. And his first was, the first one he would go to was called Chambers Dictionary of the English Language, given to him by his favorite aunt, Auntie Len. And so that was the first stop, but that usually wasn't enough. It would require going to the Oxford English Dictionary, of which he had all 20 volumes. And he adored that. And he was someone, sexy as this sounds, who would bring a dictionary to bed.
Awesome.
To read.
That's great.
To read. So yeah, Oliver the OED and I. Me.
All right. Well, on that note, you all know what to do before bed tonight. I'd like to thank this amazing group of people. Steve Silberman, Dr. Victoria Sweet, Billy Hayes.
Thank you.
Oh, this is, I'm Kate Edgar, and now I get to do the gavel thing. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you very much.